Thank you all for being here tonight. On behalf of our chair, Jim Harms, our associate chair, Tim Sweet, our procurer of cookies and everything wonderful, Laura Brady. She gave out cookies at a meeting the other day. I still remember them. And on behalf of my fellow creative writers, Jim Harms, Kevin Oderman, Ethel Morgan Smith, Alyssa High, Glenn Taylor, and Marianne Salmon, welcome, welcome, welcome. We're glad you're here. I'm Mark Brazidis, by the way. I was, anyway, a minute ago. I think I still am. Tonight's presidential debate reminds me of another presidential debate 24 years ago. This debate pitted Republican George H.W. Bush against Democrat Michael Dukakis. It was the last time a presidential candidate of a major political party declared opposition to the death penalty. Dukakis did so memorably or notoriously in that 1988 debate when, in response to a panelist's question about whether he would favor the death penalty in a case in which his, Dukakis's, wife was raped and murdered, the candidate said no and answered calmly and rationally why. In the aftermath of the debate, Republicans, the media, and even his fellow Democrats vilified his answer. Apparently, they wanted Dukakis to announce he would strangle the theoretical rapist and murderer with his bare hands, rip off his head, and serve it on a platter to Willie Horton. Subsequent presidential candidates, yes, even Bill Clinton, have bolstered their pro-death penalty credentials by, as governors, allowing the execution of a man who didn't understand his criminal sentence, Clinton as governor of Arkansas, and the first woman to face the death penalty in 14 years, a born-again Christian who received petitions of support for clemency from the Pope and the Prime Minister of Italy, George W. Bush, as governor of Texas. No presidential candidate since 1988 has had the courage to say no, not even on the basis of the increasingly troubling fact that in case after case, prosecutors, judges, and juries have gotten it wrong. They have accused, convicted, and sentenced to death innocent men and women, and the obvious fact that the death penalty has always been deeply racist and classist. It takes a particular courage to say no to the death penalty. Being against the death penalty isn't as widely accepted as, say, being in favor of an end to world hunger. In fact, as our politics tells us, it isn't much accepted, period. But let me pause here so I can interject a little about tonight's reader. If Katie Ryan, an associate professor in the Department of English and the editor of Demands of the Dead, believes in a separation between what we do in this building and what we do in the world, the wall is as thin as air, as thin as breath. As you will hear and learn tonight, Katie Ryan's scholarly work tangles with the theoretical but confronts the existential head on. As a country, we, or enough of us, have decided it's okay to answer murder with murder, an eye for an eye, no, a life for a life. Why have we, or enough of us, made this choice? What are its consequences, not only on the condemned or the victims of crime, but on all of us, as members of a society that claims to condemn murder at the same time it condones it? Who are the people whose crimes we have designated capital offenses? Who are their families? What were the circumstances of their birth and childhood? What do their voices sound like? Why are they overwhelmingly people of color? What are they saying about the conditions they live in? What does it feel like to be condemned, to watch a clock and know the exact finiteness of its ticks? What in all of this is just? Courage, back to courage. I admire Katie Ryan's courage so very much. As a scholar and as the founder of the Appalachian Prison Book Project, whose mission is the simple but not so simple aim of putting books into the hands of women and men imprisoned in Appalachia, Katie has turned her professional and personal passions toward misunderstood, stereotyped, scorned, and damned human beings, people whom so many of us have given up on, have written off, have murdered metaphorically, if not in reality. Katie advocates for people whose voices so many of us would prefer not to hear, people who live in institutionalized mufflers, their dignity battered, their words cut off. Katie Ryan has the courage to say there's something wrong with what is happening here, with what our society has agreed upon as just retribution. She also has the wisdom to say there is a better way, and the decency and faith to say there is hope. The human being isn't a static machine. If he commits a wrong, even a heinous wrong, there is, as long as there is life, a chance he will find the light. Please welcome Katie Ryan.
Thanks, Mark, for that beautiful introduction and also for getting hired the same year that I did. I'm amazed every day by the work that Mark does and the manner in which he does it. Thanks to all of you for being here. I want to thank Marcia Bassett for the publicity for tonight and for always being so calm. I'm thankful to all of my friends at the Appalachian Prison Book Project, many of whom are here. As Mark mentioned, the project sends free books to women and men who are imprisoned. We respond to individual letters requesting reading materials, and we do our best to find a good book and send it off. So let me know tonight if you're interested in joining us in that work. My acknowledgments in the book begin with my parents. My dad taught me, by example, to distrust the barbed wire, not the people inside. My mom has always encouraged me to write, to think, to love. I'm indebted to two men I met on death row through my dad in Illinois, Ronaldo Hudson and William X. For almost 20 years, they have shared their lives and letters with me, and they have taught me about freedom. As I was working on this book, my son Vincent saw a photo of two people at a demonstration carrying signs against the death penalty. It was one of those circles with a line through the electric chair. And he asked why these people were against chairs. And I stammered and hesitated and interrupted myself to say, "You're only six. I don't want to dump all the meanness of the world onto you." And he said, "I want to know everything." In this spirit, I also thank Tilly Olson for writing Tell Me a Riddle, for giving us Eva, a Russian immigrant, a lover of Chekhov, mother of seven, who knows. Everything that happens, one must try to understand why. My talk is in 17 and a half parts. It was a challenge for me to prepare. I'm not making a literary argument, which is my usual mode, nor am I doing a creative reading. I will try to give you a sense of this collection that is built from 18 contributors and includes poems, performance scripts, personal and critical essays. I've asked students to help me tonight. They are going to be reading works from the collection and quotes from letters that we receive at the Prison Book Project. So I'm going to talk for about 35 minutes, and then I'm going to turn it over to them. The United States has puzzled for centuries over the most humane way to kill people: hanging, gunfire, poisonous gas, electrocution, or lethal injection. A teenager named Willie Francis dispensed with such concerns in the middle of the 20th century. "I wasn't worried at all whether it would hurt me," Francis explained about Louisiana's portable electric chair. "I was more worried about the fact it was going to kill me." The death penalty is often imagined as a matter of simple calculus, a life for a life. Politicians and prosecutors who support state killing perform an allegiance to law and to grieving citizens, crafting a story of necessity and somber judgment. David Dow, who has represented over 100 capital defendants in Texas, knows the importance of storytelling in the legal system. He writes in his autobiography, "The facts matter, but the stories matter more." If capital punishment depends upon oversimplified narratives of personal responsibility, Demands of the Dead provides more full and unsettling narratives of political and personal violence. A government employee inserting a needle filled with fatal chemicals into a person's body is not an act of God or justice, but the culmination of a series of deliberate calculations and very human actions, and the repetition of a race-based history of violence. The United States has the highest rate of imprisonment in the world. A vast penal system is woven into our landscape and our culture. Over 2 million people live in cages. This network is intimately connected with children who catch pre-dawn buses to make visiting hours, with parents who write letters every week, with victims of violent crime who fear release dates, with stock options in private prison corporations, with ongoing and exported torture. Bruce Franklin, who's the leading scholar in American prison literary studies and who's a contributor to the book and who helped me from start to finish, argues, if we teach modern American literature without reference to the American prison and its literature, we are behaving like those who fail to see, hear, or speak about slavery and its literature. On the day that the federal government killed Ethel and Julius Rosenberg in 1953, Sylvia Plath wrote in her journal, "There is no yelling, no horror, no great rebellion. That is the appalling thing. Two real people being executed, no matter. The largest emotional reaction over the United States will be a rather large, democratic, infinitely bored, and casual and complacent yawn." There was more than a yawn. Protests took place nationally and internationally, but Sylvia Plath recognized a complacency about state killing, and she rightly connected it to American democracy. It would take me a long time to see the haunting prison in American literature, to hear the echo of Melville Sailor calling out as he climbs aboard a British naval ship, "Goodbye to you, old rights of man," to slow down at the beginning of the Scarlet Letter. The founders of a new colony, whatever utopia of human virtue and happiness they might originally project, have invariably recognized it among their earliest practical necessities to allot a portion of the virgin soil as a cemetery and another portion as the site of a prison. In accordance with this rule, it may be assumed safely that the forefathers of Boston had built the first prison house almost as seasonably as they had marked out the first burial ground. In his novel Boston, published in 1928, Upton Sinclair tells the story of a widow-turned-activist, Cornelia Thornwell, who joins the struggle to save the lives of Sacco and Vanzetti. In the hours before the executions, Cornelia feels as if she had taken Dante's place in a journey through the various stages of hell. All this elaborate display of killing power, 1,000 intricate and ingenious inventions, all the arts and sciences which civilization had contrived, applied to the wholesale and instantaneous wiping out of human life. Especially unforgiving of academics, Cornelia considers the wealth and resources of Harvard. So many hundreds of professors of every kind of subject on earth, and they couldn't teach anything worthwhile. A couple years later, in 1931, Langston Hughes wrote a one-act play called Scottsboro Limited. It was just months after 9 African-Americans, all under the age of 20, had been convicted of raping 2 young white women on a train in Alabama. Despite a spectacular lack of evidence and improbable testimony, 8 of the 9 teenagers were sentenced to die. The youngest, Leroy Wright, was sentenced to life in prison. One of the accusers, Ruby Bates, would soon recant her testimony and work for the defendant's release. Hughes's play, which ends with a smashing of a wooden chair that stands for the death penalty, was printed in New Masses and performed at organizing meetings. It calls for a simple set and limited cast. It's an example of what William Maxwell calls the ambulatory aesthetics of 1930 agitprop drama. Hughes published an illustrated edition of the play along with 4 poems to raise money for the defense. On at least one occasion, police prevented the play from being shown. And around this time, Hughes commented in a column, "I have never known the police of any country to show an interest in lyric poetry as such. But when poems stopped talking about the moon and began to mention poverty, trade unions, color lines, and colonies, somebody tells the police." I wanted to work on this collection to understand the American literary record of resistance to the death penalty, to study writers and to include contemporary ones who explore the appeal, the administration, and the atrocity of the penalty of death. A simple public list tells us who is likely to be killed in the coming months, how, and when, and where. This is a peculiar knowledge, and it connects us to more violent death, unfathomable grief. Executions hold extraordinary promise for some, but not all family members of murder victims, and it does not take any leap of my imagination to arrive at how someone would want a person to suffer and to die. This is not simple bloodlust to me, but a human response to an experience that shatters everything. Victims' family members often feel their needs and voices are marginalized by the legal system or cynically used and forgotten. Although the state prosecutes, at least theoretically, on behalf of the public for the public good, it will, when it suits, mobilize the private emotions of survivors. But the war on drugs is not about drugs, and the death penalty is not about healing people, and a good man, as Flannery O'Connor taught us, is hard to find. My title comes from Antigone, who tells her sister early in the play, it is the dead, not the living, who make the greatest demands. My cover reproduces a photograph of one tombstone among 2,000 in a cemetery in Huntsville, Texas. For 150 years, people have been buried here who die in prison and have no one to claim their bodies or whose families cannot afford a private burial. I learned about this cemetery from one of the contributors, Elizabeth Stein, who co-produces a radio program out of Houston whenever there's an execution in Texas. It's called Execution Watch. She co-produces that with a former prisoner. She contributed a screenplay to the collection about a man who's about to be executed and does not want his body to end up in what is known as Peckerwood Hill, the cemetery in Huntsville. No records were kept of the people buried here until 1974. There are still no names on the tombstones, just numbers, and the people who have been executed have an X by their number. So you can glance at the cover of my book, but those up front can see the date of the execution is down the vertical line, and across the horizontal is the X, and then the prisoner number, 740 in Texas. So I just want to mention some 20th century American literary works that focus on a capital trial or execution. Richard Wright's Native Son, Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, Arthur Miller's The Crucible, E.L. Doctorow's Book of Daniel, Luis Valdez's Zoot Suit, Ernest Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, and William Huey's The Execution of Eddie Slovak, which tells of the only American soldier executed in World War II. That's a shooting that Kurt Vonnegut also alludes to in Slaughterhouse-Five. And of course, Norman Mailer's stunning account of Gary Gilmore's death and Executioner's Song. Gilmore was the first person executed after the death penalty was reinstated in 1976. After a four-year moratorium, he was killed the next year in 77 in Utah. Dave Eggers is quite right when he says that Executioner's Song is the quickest 1,000 pages you'll ever read. Tim Adams recommended to me years ago that I read, since I was studying Executioner's Executioner's Song, that I also read Shot in the Heart, which is an autobiography written by Gilmore's brother, Michal Gilmore. This is a beautiful and devastating book. He was a writer for Rolling Stones. He details his family's history and his brother's experience of protracted abuse and violence, which Mailer had no way of knowing about. His brother was one of those, Michal Gilmore writes, who had the possibility of murder jammed deep inside their hearts at an early age. One investigator late in Executioner's Song speculate about what occasions persons turn toward violence, and that's really Michael Gilmore's search in this book, is what is the starting point for murder. But in Executioner's Song, one of the voices does wonder if the key to every violent criminal could be found in the file of his childhood beatings. Literary scholars in the collection discuss these works as well as anti-gallows writings from the early 19th century and late 19th century fiction that addresses the new use of electricity in executions, including Edison's peculiar involvement in all of that. Post-1960s poems by Sonia Sanchez, Michael Harper, Etheridge Knight, Larry Neal, Derrida's final lectures on capital punishment. And there's a great essay by a scholar who teaches at University of California, Davis, Matthew Stratton. He offers an analysis of Walter Benjamin and De Lynch Mob's hip-hop album, Gorillas in the Mist. And his takeaway point, and it's one that he really draws from the album, is that statistics, unlike art, will never liberate us. My essay responds to the recent documentary play, The Exonerated, which is crafted from legal transcripts and interviews with people, as Mark mentioned, who have been sentenced to die and were later cleared and released. Through a popular mix of Hollywood star power, documentary theater, and sentimentalism, The Exonerated elicits sympathy for people who have suffered through terrible judicial error. Like The Innocent Argument against the death penalty, it also veers attention from another critical fact. Most people on death row have killed someone. Some writers dramatize the moral and political dimensions of executions without taking a stand. Some openly champion an abolitionist, like Hughes does, or retentionist position. And a few writers are unexpectedly, even posthumously, pulled into the debate. In 2002, the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional the execution of people with a form of disability called mental retardation. This was a categorical ruling. Anyone diagnosed as such could not be killed. But the court left it up to the states to decide who has mental retardation. 2 years later, in 2004, a Texas Court of Appeals upheld the execution of a man with an IQ of 61, well below the threshold for mental retardation in Texas, which they had established at 70. The court argued that Marvin Wilson did not exhibit certain behaviors, and in a surprising move, referred in its decision to Of Mice and Men. Texas citizens might agree that Steinbeck's Lenny should, by virtue of his lack of reasoning ability and adaptive skills, be exempt. But does a consensus of Texas citizens agree that all persons who might legitimately qualify for assistance under the social services definition of mental retardation be exempt from an otherwise constitutional penalty? So one wonders who these Texas citizens are who can come to a consensus about Of Mice and Men. But Steinbeck's son issued a statement very quickly saying, I find the whole premise to be insulting, outrageous, ridiculous, and profoundly tragic. Marvin Wilson was executed in Texas a little over a month ago. To understand how and why the United States persists with a practice that has been abandoned by most countries in the world and all other Western democracies, I offer in my introduction three contexts for thinking about state homicide, and homicide is the word that's used on death certificates after an execution. One is the cultural performance of execution, two is the larger carceral system, and three, the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. So I just want to touch very quickly on all of these. The gallows once drew crowds of thousands to witness the righteous authority of the government, the wretched status of the condemned, with the movement away from public executions beginning in the North in the 1830s and continuing through the early part of the 20th century in the South, and accelerated in the South by the introduction of the electric chair. The state consolidated its control over killing scenes. Often described as barbaric, the death penalty is also an essentially modern and adaptable instrument of state power. The removal of the scaffold from public view coincided with other changes in criminal punishment. In the late 18th and 19th century, European and US reformers recommended an alternative to corporal punishment. No longer would the captive body be subjected to overt violence, no longer screwed to the rack, drawn and quartered. The soul would become the site of corrections. Isolated in a cell, chastened by silence, disciplined by labor, the prison would reflect and become penitent, journey through death to rejoin the human family, reborn, rehabilitated. Or so the story went. There has long been a disjunction, as Jason Hassam writes, between the supposedly humanist intentions of the prison project and its actual brutalizing effects. There's been great work done lately on the severe mental damage, really disintegration of the mind that is caused by solitary confinement. One of the contributors is named Rick Stetter, and he's formerly a university press editor, but he's worked in Texas as a guard for years and also as a sheriff's assistant. And he describes working in the isolation unit in one of the Texas prisons where in over 100 degree heat, men strip naked to lie on the cement floor. And he writes, most people from the free world would find conditions in segregation to be quite literally hell on earth. There was discussion earlier this year about moving the remaining Guantanamo prisoners to a supermax in Illinois. One of their attorneys from the Center for Constitutional Rights noted that at this point, most of his clients in Guantanamo are being held under something close to the Geneva Conventions. At Thompson in Illinois, they would be thrown into the equivalent of a supermax under near lockdown conditions. As far as our clients are concerned, he said, it's probably preferable for them to remain at Guantanamo. And of course, suicides and hunger strikes are also going on in Guantanamo, so it's a fairly low threshold. With the rise of the modern penitentiary, execution persisted and punishment remained. And this next line comes from Caleb Smith's wonderful book, Prison in the American Imagination. At a deep level, what punishment had already been in the earlier age of the scaffold and the pillory, a theater for the performance of society's founding myths. Since 1976, 80% of executions have taken place in the South. There's a correlation between counties that have high lynching, that had high lynching rates 100 years ago, and counties that have high execution rates today. The 1930s, the decade with the highest number of legal killings, executions, was also the decade that saw a significant drop in the number of extrajudicial killings or lynchings. Demands of the Dead asks whether the tale told about US democracy and human rights conflicts with imprisonment or depends upon it. The legacy of slavery, of convict leasing, which really was a kind of death penalty, and deference to states' rights, these three things, the legacy of slavery, the convict leasing system, and deference to state rights, creates a capacious legal space that can and does pronounce death in multiple directions. Angela Davis notes, when discriminatory practices become institutionalized, white bodies can also bear the brunt of racist violence. Hayward Patterson was one of the nine young men pulled off that train in Alabama. He offers an important take on innocence, one that I think is quite different than what the exonerated is doing, in his neglected autobiography, Scottsboro Boy, from 1950. After a dozen trials and two U.S. Supreme Court decisions, Alabama agreed in 1937, that was 6 years after the initial convictions, to release four of the imprisoned, the two youngest and the two with the most severe medical problems. Hayward Patterson remarks he was not one of the four released. He actually would remain in prison until 1948 when he escaped from a prison farm and he got to Michigan, and Michigan refused to extradite him back to Alabama. Hayward Patterson remarks, of those four that were released, the state said they weren't guilty of rape, so they had been punished enough. This phrasing does not suggest judicial error in the pursuit of truth, but recognize the operation of biopolitics, the management of bodies to be disciplined and punished. Michel Foucault argued that the prison system, the modern system of imprisonment, is not failing. High recidivism rates are not failure. Routine violence in prison is not a failure. Imprisoning innocent people is not failing. Prison works. To disappear, always and completely, social problems. Homelessness, unemployment, addiction, sexual and physical abuse, mental unwellness. And to control and surveil public space, especially black and urban. As George Jackson put it, the ultimate expression of law is not order, it's prison. I try not to fall into that rabbit hole of numbers in my work, but I'm about to. I just want to mention one Supreme Court case from 1987 called McCluskey versus Kemp. It deals with racial disparities and is often discussed in prison studies. It was a capital case. The defense, represented by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, cited a study of 2,000 murder cases in Georgia. It was called the Baldus Study. It was the largest and most sophisticated of its kind at the time. It took into consideration over 300 non-racial variables. The study concluded that people who murder white people, regardless of their race, are more likely to be sentenced to death than people who murder black people, and that black people who have murdered are more likely to be sentenced to death than white people who have murdered. So we're looking at both the race of the victim and the race of the defendant. For instance, in one model, which took into account 39 non-racial variables, if the defendant was black and the victim was white, the black defendant was 4.3 times more likely to be executed than if the victim had also been black. The Supreme Court took these findings seriously and accepted the study and its methodologies, but it also ruled in favor of the prosecution, arguing, and this was the case of a black defendant and a white victim, arguing that the petitioner had not shown bias in this particular case. I spoke with Brian Stevenson many years ago, who's the director of the Equal Justice Initiative, and he told me about a case in Utah, which he was part of the legal team for, in which a man named William Andrews was sentenced to die, and the bailiff had found in the juror room a note from one of the jurors where it was like a little hangman, and then the letters N-I, you know, two missing, and then E-R. And the bailiff found this in the juror room, gave it to the judge, and that case was not dismissed on those grounds of having shown bias. So he was talking about in the case of McCluskey that you had to show particular bias in cases. I'm not sure what else we can, well, how much more we can show. But it gets to this issue of patterns. Okay, so writing for the majority in McCluskey, Justice Lewis Powell added, if we accept in McCluskey's claim that racial bias has tainted the capital sentencing decision, we could soon be faced with similar claims as to other types of penalty. It could be extended to apply to claims based on unexplained discrepancies that correlate to membership in other minority groups, even to gender. Justin Brennan memorably wrote in his dissent that the court seemed to fear too much justice. Justice Powell later told his biography that his fifth deciding vote in McCluskey was the only vote he regretted. Now enclosed within prison walls, state killing minimizes the chance of disturbance from unruly masses whose enthusiasm for blood might reflect poorly on the government or whose sympathies might be dangerously aroused for the condemned. In general, executions elicit scant news coverage and modest, if any, protest. The execution of Troy Anthony Davis last year was a striking exception. Hundreds of people gathered outside the Georgia Diagnostic and Classification Prison in support of Davis, and more than 1 million signed petitions calling for clemency. Most states require a few members from the press and general public to attend. Some states allow family members of the person to be killed to be present, as well as relatives of the murder victim. There's a suit in Pennsylvania about at what point reporters can see the death chamber right now in Pennsylvania. This was based on a man who was actually supposed to be executed tonight, but he received a stay. So the newspapers had sued, saying that they should be able to see the prisoner from the minute they enter into the death chamber. Right now in Pennsylvania, the drape opens, and it literally is a drape, only opens after the person is strapped down. Idaho and California courts have both decided that witnesses have to be able to see the person from the minute they enter the death chamber. So a careful script is obviously outlined to ensure the cooperation of all the correctional officers and the person to be killed. Sister Helen Prejean recounts a warden's advice to Dobie Williams, a man about to be killed in Louisiana, and his family. We're all in this and have to do our part. It's best for Dobie if you're strong and not crying and broken up. See, he's strong. God's with us. God's with him. It's like Shakespeare says, all the world's a stage, and each of us has a role to play, which is in God's hands, and I'm playing my role, and you're playing yours. In 2000, Shaka Sankofa refused the script. Guards had to use mace to force him out of his cell. Other men and women are too frightened to walk or to speak. Protocols instruct witnesses on how to respond. In San Quentin, loud sobbing is not permitted. You will be removed immediately and without discussion. Texas requires the audience to refrain from verbal outbursts. One purpose of ritual, of course, and this comes from Dwight Conkergood, a performance studies scholar, is to make sense of contradictions, to provide a symbolic vision that can withstand the eruptive power of paradox. I want to play for you now just two very brief clips from a sound documentary called Witness to an Execution. The first one, you will hear a man who has been part of a tie-down team in Texas. And then the second clip will be witnesses to an execution.
As a member of the tie-down team and his spiritual advisor. At 4:30, he's given his last meal. But I'm going to start our story where the execution process really begins. At 6:05, I'm sitting in my office. I get up from my chair, put on my jacket, and walk back to the death house. At this time, the inmate is in his cell, talking with the prison's chaplain, Jim Brazel.
I've had more than one of the same. I had one offender tell lawyer jokes. You know, that was his time during that 5 minutes right before he was executed, wanted to tell lawyer jokes. And I've had him want to do exercises, do calisthenics sitting in there, you know, because it's such a nervous time. Because at that time, reality is truly setting in, and in just a few moments, he's going to be dead.
One of my supervisors will get a call at 6:00 from the governor's office and one from the attorney general's office telling us that it's okay to go ahead with this execution. The inmate will be in the second cell, and I usually go down there and I call him by his name and tell him it's time to come with me to the next room.
He'll walk up to the cell where we are and he'll say it's time. And so they will unlock the cell, and he's not handcuffed or chained, you know, he's just sitting there. And he and I will walk into the chamber.
When he gets into the chamber, I'll tell him to sit down on the gurney and then lay down with his head on the pillow. At that time, when he gets in there, all of the straps are undone, and within probably 30, 45 seconds, the officers have him completely strapped in.
My name is Kenneth Dean, and I've participated in approximately over 100 executions as a member of the tie-down team. Each supervisor is assigned a different portion, like we have a head person, a right arm, right leg, left leg, and the right leg man will tell him, I need you to hop up on the gurney, lay your head on this end, put your feet on this end. Simultaneously, while he's laying down, the straps are being put across him.
I'm Captain Terry Graham, a member of the tie-down team and the execution process. What I do, I will strap the offender's left wrist, and then there are two belts, one that comes across the top of his left shoulder, and then another goes right straight across his abdominal area.
Some of them are very calm, some of them are upset, some of them are crying.
Some of them been sweating, some of them will have the smell of anxiety, if you will, of fear.
Usually within about 20 seconds, he's completely strapped down, 20 to 30 seconds. I mean, it's down to a fine art.
It's basically a situation where we just make sure he's secure, that he won't be jumping up, that he won't be able to squirm out of the restraints themselves, and that the job can be done, the job being the execution itself.
After all the straps are done, they will look at you and they'll say, thank you. And here you've just strapped a man to the table, and they look at you in the eye and they tell you thank you for everything that you've done. And, you know, that's kind of a weird feeling.
I had a mother
in silent night. He made
it. Seems like they should draw in all the air they can.
And then whenever that breath goes, it's like a snore. I mean, it's like kind of like taking a balloon and squishing that balloon and the sound that a balloon makes when you're squishing the air out of it.
Generally, there's some erratic movement on the part of the inmate, some coughing, sputtering, occasionally a gasp. Then there's quiet.
I've had several of them where watching their last breath go from their bodies and their eyes never take unfixed from mine. You know, I'm just actually locked together. And I close my eyes now and see those eyes. My feelings and my emotions are extremely intense at that time. I've never really been able to describe it. And I guess in a way I'm kind of afraid to describe it. I've never really delved into that part of my feelings yet.
A third chemical actually stops the heart.
At that point, and it's just something out of tradition, and I certainly haven't messed with it because it's worked, I was told to wait 3 minutes from that point, and I have kept it to a T on 3 minutes.
You see no more breathing, you hear no more sounds, it's just waiting.
I had a mother collapse right in front of me. We were standing virtually shoulder to shoulder. She collapsed, hit the floor, went into hyperventilation and almost convulsions.
I've seen family members collapse in there. I've seen them scream and wail. I've seen them beat the glass.
I've seen them fall into the floor, totally lose control. And yet, how do you tell a mother that she can't be there in the last moments of her son's life?
You'll never hear another sound like a mother wailing whenever she's watching her son be executed. There's no other sound like it. It is just this horrendous wail. You can't get away from it. That wail surrounds the room. It's definitely something you won't ever forget.
The later in the documentary, we hear from a guard who had to quit because he started suffering from PTSD. So I want to just end my section here by saying that I think of Demands of the Dead as moving in that direction of too much justice, trying to imagine and create truly democratic institutions, or what W.E.B. Du Bois calls abolition democracy. And there's extraordinarily hopeful work being done in this area by those involved in restorative justice, by Jim Nolan, who is here tonight from the sociology department, who teaches criminology classes as part of the Inside Out program, former police officer, former FBI agent, and just an all-around wonderful person. So thank you, Jim, for being here. By family members and friends of murder victims, by family members and friends of prisoners, by hunger-striking prisoners in California and across the country, by artists and writers and students, and by needed alliances like this. In the 1990s, a sheriff in California supported an unusual visual art installation in a county jail, and he acknowledged, is it unusual for a sheriff to support the art efforts of an artist who is a self-described prison abolitionist? Yes, it is. But Richard Hemler and I have one significant thing in common. We both agree that traditional jails do not work. I share Richard's hope that one day we will see the trend toward more freedom and hope, not less. It was a joy to work with every single contributor to the book. Everyone was generous and committed and very inspiring. I worked with two men on death row in San Quentin, Steve Champion and Anthony Ross. Steve details in his essay an intense regimen of study he undertook once he was in prison. With Anthony Ross and Stanley Tookie Williams, all of them former Crips. Williams was executed in 2005. They would quiz one another on the yard about theology, geography, history, literature. In the midst of war, Steve recalls, we were becoming writers. He describes how disappointed he would be at times when he would send out his writing and receive rejection notices. But then he describes the fantastic moment in his life when he fell in love with the process of writing. In a very brief meditative essay, Anthony explains, if he's ever asked for a final statement, he will shake his head. I'm not big on monologue. There is obviously some difficulties in collaborating with people in prison. There's no email. Phone calls are terribly expensive. Mail can be slow or lost entirely, but these voices are so critical. So I want you to hear Steve Champion's voice. There's a 30-second clip that I have thanks to a professor at Ithaca College in New York. Prison sounds behind him. Kia Corthoran is another contributor to the collection. She's written over 20 plays, won all kinds of awards, including an award for a TV episode of The Wire that she wrote. I knew she'd written a play on the death penalty, but it had not been published, and I couldn't find it. I was able to track her down, and her play, Life by Asphyxiation, really became a centerpiece for me. It's set in the present with Crazy Horse and Nat Turner on death row, next to Jojo, a black man in his 50s. Jojo is visited by Katie, a white girl whom he raped and murdered when she was 15. Kia rivets attention on liberation struggle, state violence, a man regretful of his past and frightened to die, and a girl who loved to play basketball. Katie does not want to hear an apology. I can't hear, I'm sorry, I'm deaf too. In a signal line for the collection, Katie also reflects murder. Once you've been through it, you never wish it on nobody else. In Louisiana, 1946, Willie Francis was convicted of killing a white pharmacist by an all-white jury in a one-day trial. He would have been 15 when the murder occurred. He was 16 when he was tried. He had no history of violence. There was no physical evidence. His attorneys did not bother to offer any kind of defense. The only evidence was a contradictory confession obtained by police. On the day of his execution, Willie Francis walked to the electric chair, was strapped down, and subjected to two separate charges of electricity, but he did not die. The men who set up the chair, it turned out, were drunk. So Willie Francis got up out of the chamber, walked back to his cell. His father took a sledgehammer to the tombstone he had bought for his son's burial. A year later, a divided Supreme Court ruled that another execution would not violate the Eighth Amendment, and Willie Francis was electrocuted to death this time. Between the botched and the final execution, Willie Francis wrote a pamphlet called My Trip to the Chair to help raise money for his defense. It's housed at the Library of Congress, and it's what opens my book, and Mike's going to be reading a selection from that. Just a little context for the rest of the readings. Jill McDonough is a poet. She heavily just won a Pushcart Prize. She's taught in Boston prisons for over a decade. Her book of poems, Habeas Corpus, contains 60 sonnets, each one focused on an execution in U.S. history. So you're going to be hearing ones on Willie Francis, on Nicola Sacco, on Eileen Wuornos, and one on a man called Chaska. And let me just say a little bit about that one. He was one of 38 Dakotas hanged in Minnesota in 1862 after being convicted of killing white settlers. Originally, the tribunals had condemned many more to die, but Lincoln pardoned 265 people, including a man known as Chaska, yet he ended up being killed either because of mistaken identification or intentional retaliation. He had allegedly taken a white woman and her children as prisoners, but the woman, Sarah Wakefield, defended Chaska at the tribunals, saying he had saved her from certain death. She felt he had been targeted for retaliation for a presumed sexual relation between them. So Valerie, Nita, Troy, and Kate will be reading those sonnets. Yvonne will read a poem by Sherman Alexie, and you'll hear three quotations from members of murder victims' families for reconciliation, Troy, Bonnie, and Kate, and reading quotations from letters to the Prison Book Project will be Dominique, Bonnie, Ian and Ryan, two of whom are among our youngest volunteers of the project, although not our very youngest. And the last poems you'll hear are by Delbert Tibbs, whose words also conclude the book. Delbert spent time on death row for a crime he did not commit and since has been devoting his life to speaking out against the death penalty and mass imprisonment. He's featured in The Exonerated and also Studs Terkel's collection, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? So Rebecca and Stephanie will end our selection of readings from Demands of the Dead. So at this point, I'm going to invite Mike to come up and start us off.